Hello, welcome to Transmedia Podcast. My name is Belén Santaolalla and you can find me online as Belén_Santa. Today I have with me Mats Haar, who is the professor at the Trinity College in Dublin and the CEO of a game studio called Haunted Planet. Hello Mats, how are you?
Hi Belén, how are you?
Today, I wanted to talk to you because you have this project going on that is called Gaming for Peace. So, what's Gaming for Peace?
So, Gaming for Peace is a collaborative project, a European project funded under the Horizon 2020 scheme. And it's a project where we are making a game to help educate peacekeepers in soft skills. So we've identified sort of a gap or in sort of skills in collaboration with some peacekeeping partners we have in the project, and they felt there was scope for educating peacekeepers better in soft skills like cultural awareness or gender awareness and communication skills. We decided to try and make a game to help people learn those skills before they get deployed on actual peacekeeping missions.
And why did you choose that a game was the best option to do so?
Well, personally, I've always been very interested in games. I mean, games was what got me interested in computers way back when I was a 13-year-old boy. And it was also kind of what got me into sort of programming and ultimately made me study computer science and sort of take that whole career path in that direction. And I'm still very excited about games. In Haunted Planet Studios, we've been making serious games for a while, so games that are not just for fun, they have to be fun too, but that they have some sort of serious purpose as well. So for a long time, we've been making location-based augmented reality games for cultural heritage sites, so games that help people engage with culture in different ways. But Gaming for Peace is really kind of a new development for us. It's a, you know, it's a game where people engage with stories that are fictional but are very real, you know, with things that these are situations you could really end up in, even if they're fictional situations that we have developed.
And what's the format of the game? How what's the role of the player in that game, for example?
So the format of the game is, it's a visual novel type game. I don't know if you're familiar with visual novel type games, but they're games where you see a scene, you know, the scene in our game here is, it's not photorealistic, you know, it's a drawn image of a setting, and then you see some characters appear on the screen and you interact with the characters by tapping and clicking, you know, on the screen. You have some dialogue options, so you can choose what to say and how to react to the things the characters say to you. So it's really like an interactive story with some visuals. So you're interacting with characters and you're exploring a scene. We have a couple of different gameplay modes, so you can explore a scene also. So sort of scroll across a market scene, for example, is one of the scenes we have, and then you can sort of tap on different things to interact with them and explore more. So it's really a very simple game concept at its core, but there's quite a lot of material there. The game is quite long. There's quite a lot of, or quite long for an educational game. It's quite long, maybe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. We're not sure yet how long it'll take people to play it. But the game, the core game idea is, it's a kind of a simple paradigm and from a player's point of view. So, and that has the advantage that it's not a difficult type of game to learn, because the audience we have for this would be novice peacekeepers. So people who have taken sort of some education in peacekeeping and will already have education as maybe as a soldier, as some military training, or they might have education as a police officer, but they haven't been on a peacekeeping mission before. So it's a game that is intended to be played before they go on their first mission, and it's intended to help them sort of learn some soft skills that could be helpful for them in that deployment. So they're not hardcore gamers, so the fact that it's kind of a simple game concept, I think, is something that is suited for this audience. They're not necessarily hardcore gamers.
Mm-hmm. And when you think of the design of a game like this, how do you approach it? How do you come up with the concept? How do you design the story behind the game?
In terms of, there's really two parts to that. So there's the choosing the game genre at first, you know, and we spend a lot of time in the first part of the project. We spend a lot of time thinking about different types of game concepts, right? We were very interested in virtual reality, for example, for a while, and we thought, oh, maybe we can make a virtual reality game, but it turned out actually that the timeline was a little too compressed for that. So we decided, okay, we're going to do a game that's a little simpler in its format, but it's a lot deeper, you know, with many more lines of dialogue and maybe many more problems to explore than we would have been able to if we'd done a virtual reality game. So that's kind of the game genre. In relation to the story, there's quite a lot of material that's gone into the game. So the project partners we have, and I should talk a little bit about them as well. So the project is being led by Trinity College, my university, but I'm actually only involved in the project through my company, through Haunted Planet. But it's led by sociology in Trinity, and we have psychology involved as well, and we have a number of other sort of smaller companies involved, often people who have to, typically people who have to do with sort of learning and to help educate peacekeepers, for example. So we have some organizations who do this. And then we have a lot of what we call the end user partners, and they are sort of military forces and police forces from across Europe. And they are the types of organizations who will ultimately be using the game. So for the story material that we're working with, as I mentioned, it's fictional, but it's based on a lot of interviews. So the sociologists have interviewed a lot of peacekeepers who are very experienced, who have maybe 20, 30 years of experience in various different deployments across the world. And they collected, I think, about 140 interviews over a period of time, where they sat them down and they got them to tell their stories about situations they'd been in, where they had to use sort of soft skills. They had to communicate in an interesting or challenging way, and had to sort of be culturally aware in different ways. So they told all these stories, and they were collected by the sociologist team. And then our writer and also actually the sociology team and the psychology team have worked with this material, and it's now being turned into the story that's going to be in the game. So we've used some of the material, sort of it's been adapted a little bit, but it's all based on very real experiences that people who were deployed in various different parts of the world had, you know, when they were on these deployments. So that's very, that's a new thing for us. We've worked a lot with sort of highly fictional material in the past, but this is very real material, even if it is sort of fictionalized a little bit, so it's not completely recognizable.
And because it's real material, how do you make this real material become something engaging? How do you, because a fiction, like a script, you know how to make it engaging, but with real material, how do you work with it to turn it into a 1.5-hour experience that still has something valuable that you want to play?
I think it has to be driven by the story and the characters. That's our thinking there, right? So we have we pay a lot of attention to the writing. So it needs to feel real, you know, the dialogue needs to feel real. All the characters need to be believable. All the environments need to be believable. The situations we put people in, you know, the players in a situation, they're challenging, right? They're not, the format is simple. You know, you encounter a character in a market maybe, and you have a conversation with them, but it's not easy to pick the right, to the extent that there is a right solution, it's not clear cut, you know, how to play it, right? You have to think about, oh, if I do this, what will the consequences be? If I do that, what will the consequences be? What is the bigger picture? So we're hoping we can draw people in with a combination of these things, right? So the believability of the game and the character and the setting, but also the sort of the challenge that's there in playing the game the right way. There's something really interesting with this collaboration, which is that we check a lot with the end users, right? So we have the end users, we have our great, so the people who've been on deployment, and they give us feedback. So we have a version of the script, for example. We have a question to them, you know, and there are little details that need to be right. So we go back to them a lot and say, oh, you know, if I'm in the Middle East, you know, and I drink tea, you know, what does the cup look like, for example, or the glass look like? All these sort of little details need to be right. For example, what does a market sound like? You know, what kind of writing would be on the walls, right? What would the buildings look like? So we interact a lot with the end users, and they give us photographs and they give us feedback, and what we've discovered is that it's super important for this game that it is believable, right? So as soon as something happens, which, you know, in earlier drafts, you know, we had of the game, we described a situation, or there was a situation maybe where there was something a little bit wrong, not like dramatically wrong, but just a little bit wrong, and then the peacekeepers, they spot it immediately, right? And they say, okay, this would never happen, right? And then we know, okay, we need to fix this. And they can be small details, but they really need to be right. And that's really a fun challenge here, that there's very little room for inaccuracies. Even though it is a sort of a fictional Middle Eastern country, you know, the people we have, they have so much experience that they can really help us sort of get the detail right. And it is really important.
Hmm, interesting. And you were talking before about consequences. They have to choose a right answer, and there are consequences. How do you approach the structure? Is it a branching narrative, or is it on rails, or how does that work?
It is fundamentally is a branching narrative. I mean, it doesn't explode completely in complexity. I mean, we do sort of, some of the branches come together again. And also, I mean, it's not always that there is a right or a wrong answer. So the game is intended to help people learn, and actually also to measure their performance. How good are they? Right. So there is you don't see a score on the screen, but we do measure, you know, which choices people make, and how do they exhibit sort of a good level of, say, cultural awareness or gender awareness or communication skills and so on. But it's not always a clear cut which is the right solution. And sometimes there's maybe multiple right solutions, or there's two really good solutions and one okay but not fantastic solution, and then there might be a completely hopeless solution. So it's not totally clear cut in that way. One of the things we want people to learn also is to see things from different perspectives, right? So in the game, you get to play two different characters, and you play them in sequence. So first, you play a woman who is a soldier and is on a peacekeeping mission. So you play a female soldier first for the first half of the game, and then after that you play a male police officer, you know, who's also in the same area but is, you know, with a different team there, and the two of them have different tasks to perform, you know, in their deployment. So you essentially experience two different perspectives of the deployment of peacekeeping, and also we try and get across what happens in these deployments in practice, which is a lot of the time it's hard for the military to know what's going on in with the civilian part of the population and the police and vice versa, right? So each of these different sort of players and the locals as well, of course, right? So each of these different groups have their own sort of perspective on what's going on, and it can be hard in practice for them to keep track of everything. So we're trying to get that across by putting you into the shoes first of a soldier, and then as a police officer, and then we try and get gender in there as well. So you get to try and play as a different gender as well as a different type of peacekeeper. We would have liked actually also to have a third character, which could be sort of an NGO, you know, person, maybe from some, you know, another type of organization than the two we have. But due to time constraints, we weren't able to do this, you know, in this version of the game, unfortunately.
But what's the difference then between the two characters? Because you play as a female military character and a male police. But what are you asking of the player to do differently in these two characters?
Well, it's not so much we're asking them to do things differently, but we're trying to bring across that that they have to operate in the same world. But that the world will react to them a little bit differently depending on, you know, on their role, right? So if you're a man or a woman in the Middle East, people react to you a little bit differently. If you're military or you're police, people are going to react to you a little bit differently. So we're trying to sort of bring that awareness in and then to navigate that space. And there are some difficult situations that we know from the interviews we have, that, you know, that they're not always clear cut. And I can give you an example. So for example, there's one of the situations we're looking at, you know, you're on a police mission and you're investigating a sort of a sexual exploitation or slash abuse situation. And you're talking to a local there who's sort of an authority figure. We're not sure if he's going to be a mayor yet or a mukhtar, but he'd be one of these. And this is based on an interview we had with some actual peacekeepers who had been on deployment. So in this situation, the male authority figure from the local department is not comfortable speaking to you. So here in this case, you play a male police officer, but you have a female partner with you. So you have to make a decision. How do you handle that, right? How do you navigate the space between sort of conservative cultural attitudes that exist there? Are you going to respect those conservative cultural attitudes, or are you going to respect your female partner's right and need to do her job, right? So that's it's not a straightforward decision, you know? That's many concerns to think about, and it's up to the player to figure out, okay, how do I handle this, right? What is the best decision? So those are tricky situations, and they're quite challenging, and we're hoping that the players will get to think quite deeply about not just the specific decisions they have to make, but also sort of the bigger context, you know, for their work as peacekeepers.
That's very interesting indeed, because I've seen that there are essays or research related to your project, to this Gaming for Peace project, in which they talk about this gender awareness and cultural awareness in peacekeeping. It's quite innovative, and maybe no one has thought about this before, how like the fact that you're a woman affects the way you deal with the locals, or some situations that they cannot be talked if there are men in the group and things like that, and even how women bring like a different perspective to peacekeeping. So it's kind of a new way of thinking about this without being like so generic. It's about really thinking about the specifics. Is that something that is a goal for the game that you're developing?
Yes, it's definitely a goal to get people to think about this. One part of the conversation is also, or has been, I think there's too much, or too often there's too much focus on what women cannot do in these situations, right? You know, a woman, you know, cannot do this or cannot do that because she's not allowed. But actually, there's a lot of things that female peacekeepers, whether they're military or police now, it doesn't necessarily matter, but there's things too that women can do that men can't do. So for example, a lot of peacekeeping work is actually just sort of everyday sort of interactions with locals, right? And sort of, you know, building sort of rapport with the locals, sort of trying to figure out what is going on, building trust and these things. And in terms of interacting with local women, for example, who that is a lot easier, probably very difficult, really, for a male peacekeeper to do. But for a female peacekeeper, she has the ability to do that to an extent that a male peacekeeper simply isn't allowed to. So I think that I hope that the game will, you know, sort of bring focus towards sort of the benefits of having women as peacekeepers, because there are still many more male peacekeepers than female peacekeepers, but there is really a real use for female peacekeepers in deployment as well, and there are things that they can do that men can't.
Really interesting. And you mentioned before about this, in the end, this game is about developing soft skills for peacekeepers. How do you measure soft skills?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have quite a formal process, and it's really my colleagues in Trinity who have developed that process, right? So we have defined a bunch of learning outcomes, you know, that we're targeting, and that we spend a lot of time, or my colleagues spend a lot of time analyzing all of the interviews that we got, figuring out, okay, what did you know, what kind of skills were exhibited, you know, in the different stories when people said, oh, you know, I had this story, you know, maybe to take that example with the with the female companion, you know, who couldn't do something or could do something. So all of these stories, they analyzed those stories and found out what was the skills or the competencies that people exhibited or didn't exhibit in these scenarios. And they have made a huge list of many, many sort of learning outcomes that we would like to target in the game. And then we trimmed it down and we focused, and we have about 40 learning outcomes, I think just under 40 now, that the game is covering. And the idea is that that the game will record what decisions are made and then try and match these against the learning outcomes to see, okay, how good is your gender awareness, or, you know, how good is your cultural awareness, you know, how good are your communication skills. But it is hard to measure, and it is something that our colleagues, you know, in Trinity are still working on, and when we deliver the game at the end of July, they will start getting people to play it and do a test before and a test after to sort of to see, does the game work as a learning tool actually? Because we don't know yet if it's really going to help people learn these things. We think and we hope, of course, that it will.
Of course it will.
but there's a step afterwards where they will figure out, you know, where, you know, how well does it work? If it does work, but. And we hope and think that it will, yes.
And do you give feedback to the player about this? Or is it something that just those who are facilitating the session see what the results were and they know if that person is more or less suited for the job? Or do they get some kind of feedback, the players, like, you did this and you should be doing instead this other thing?
There will be some feedback that the players get. We're still deciding exactly how that will work. One of the project partners is working on is this idea of a skills passport. So the idea is that if you do well in the game, or actually also if you don't do so well, but, you know, depending on your performance in the game, we will extract some, essentially like a little sort of professional certificate, you know, like a skills passport that shows these are the skills that I have and I've demonstrated it in this game. And then you can use that skills passport essentially to show to potential employers and so on. That's one of our project partners is working on that. So that could be one possible sort of feedback people get. But they'll also get sort of more specific feedback, you know, sort of intended maybe to... shortly after the play session. They'll also get some feedback during the game. I mean, because they have to deal with the consequences of their actions, right? So if they make a decision that alienates another character, then that character will be harder to interact with in the future, right? And they may not want to talk to them, or maybe they'll be more helpful if they make the right decision and so on. So there's kind of an implicit kind of game reward there in some instances, or a penalty. But there will also be more sort of structured feedback after the game.
So the reward of the game is like the intrinsic way, like through the storytelling. There are no like points or badges or something like that. It's just more like the consequence of your action. It's reflected in the story on the way you progress through the game, right?
Yes. Yeah. So we're not planning to have like a score on the screen saying, you know, your cultural awareness is now 80% or something. We're not planning to do that, right? Because mm-hmm. we think it would be distracting. And also we want people not to focus on gaming the system. We don't want them to be focused on the metrics or on the high score. We want them to genuinely think about the situations that we're presenting to them and think, okay, what would be the best decision, right? And rather than trying to optimize, because a lot of gaming is often about optimize, how do I get the most points or the most resources or whatever it is. But we want them to think deeply about the situations that they're in. And we think that something that's too game mechanical in that way will distract them from the scenarios.
Okay. And how do you plan to have the players play the game? Is it like in a training facility, all of them together playing, or is this intended to be done like self-paced, so they do it on their own time? How do you plan to do that?
What we're envisioning now, initially when the game is finished, our colleagues are going to put it on some, you know, laptops and iPads or whatever, and take them around and get people to play them. So it'll be played initially in a controlled environment. And that is also what we're thinking right now. That's probably the best way to do it. So it'll be part of if we can show that it works and it turns out that people, you know, learn enough that it's worth it, then we would like to make it part of an educational process already. So somebody who's might already be a police officer and they're taking extra education to become a peacekeeper, then this game could be sort of part of that educational process. So that in that context, they would probably play it, you know, in some sort of, academy or, you know, maybe in their organization as part of their education. So they'd probably be sat down in front of a laptop or a tablet and then play it there.
Nice. And before we talk about some other projects of yours, if you had more time or more budget, or what would you have done differently? What have you learned, or what would you like to do differently if you had a chance?
If we'd had more time, I mean, we would have loved to have more time for this project, because it is a very compressed timeline. I think the first thing we would have liked to do would be to have one more character, right? We would have loved to have an NGO character also. So someone from, Doctors Without Borders or something like that, it would be great to have a third character there. We could also have had a local character and so on. When we've done workshops with our end users, the feedback we got was that this idea of having the different perspectives was something they really liked. And they said, this really helps understand the different points of view on the same situation, right? They all, the military and the police and the NGOs and the locals are all sharing that space, you know, where the three groups are deployed and the fourth group live there, right? But they're all sharing this space, and our end users felt that this idea of seeing the different perspective on other people's, on the other group's work was really helpful. So we would have loved to have a third, sort of like the NGO group. That would have been great. With the graphics, I can share some graphics with you. We would have liked to have more time for graphics also, to do more animations of the characters and so on. Right now, the characters, they look very realistic, and I like them a lot. And if we had more time and more money, we would, I think, like to bring them to life even more than we are able to do within this project. We've also thought about, say, dialogue. You know, voice acting is often a nice thing to have, but we have so much dialogue in this game that it would really, that would take a long time. We're expecting to have, when we're done, we expect to have about 8,000 to 10,000 lines of dialogue. So it's a big amount, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. And yeah, that's it, yeah.
Okay. So you said that this project is something that it's a part of a Horizon 2020 scheme. But you had like a lot of experience in immersion in general and interactive digital narratives. You've been part of a Routledge book, right, where you've been writing about immersion and the famous holodeck. What can you tell us about immersion now that immersion is everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, there's a really good paper that I recommend to your listeners by Ermi and Myra that talks about immersion in gaming specifically, and they distinguish between three types of immersion. So sensory immersion, which is where you're drawn in to the experience. This is about games now, right? So where you're drawn into the experience because what you see and hear is so real, right? So think super realistic graphics, you know, great audio. You really feel like you're there. That's sensory immersion. Another type of immersion would be challenge-based immersion, where you really get drawn into the game experience, you know, interacting with the game mechanics, you know, and this is very similar to the concept of flow. I don't know if your listeners might be familiar with the concept of flow as described by Csikszentmihalyi. So you get drawn into the play experience itself, right? And then there's the last type of immersion is imaginative immersion, right? And this is where you're drawn into the stories. You really empathize with the characters and the situations they're in, and so on. So for our games, we have been focusing mainly on imaginative immersion for a long time. I mean, I've always been interested in stories, and the games that I've worked on have always been story-driven games, so that's really where we're coming from. We're focusing on imaginative immersion, and sometimes there's tension between these different types of immersion, right? So we've been making location-based games for a long time. So the Gaming for Peace project is a very different project for us, but for the location-based games, our games have really been focusing on imaginative immersion there. So we've been making games that have stories in them, but they're set in the real world, and you go and find the characters, and that uncovers a story. But if you look at other location-based games like Pokemon Go, which was very popular and still is, I think, they're not interested in sensory immersion. The graphics are very cartoony. They're not interested in imaginative immersion, really, not so much, because there's no story really there. You're just collecting the characters. But it's all about challenge-based immersion. It's collecting things, right? And it's training things and battling the Pokemon against each other. And that is a game where the immersion kind of, I think, works. It's almost too much challenge-based immersion, because people lose their sense of presence in the physical space, and then they get into accidents and so on. So that's a big challenge, I think, for the Pokemon Go team, sort of to balance that. But they focused on one type of immersion. We're focusing on another one. So I think there's space for different games to engage with different types of immersion and use it in different ways. So, but we're with imaginative immersion. That's where we fit in the picture.
But that's very interesting, because I see that we have like this story-based immersion and the challenge-based immersion. But for the case of Pokemon Go, it has worked pretty well as a challenge-based immersion, because it's a game that has lasted for years. Can a story-based immersion game last for years, so it doesn't, like, you're watching a TV show and in the end you're just fed up of the characters, or in the end they finish because the storylines are just dead. There's nothing else to tell about that. So how is it possible to have a story-based immersion game to run for years, for example?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. I mean, our story-based games are games that you might play maybe a few times, right? Because, and then you know the story, right? Even if a game uses story-based immersion and it's a non-linear story, right? So that is branching structure, you could take different paths and so on, and you have a different experience maybe each time you play. But at some point, you will have played, you will know the story, you'll know the characters. There's not going to be a lot of new there. So I think it's a really good point that you raise. I think challenge-based immersion is great for keeping people playing the same game, right? People can keep engaging. And what's happening with the player for those types of games is really that they're learning the system, right? They're learning how to play, and they get better and better at it. So it's a if you have a really good game that's nicely balanced, and I think Pokemon Go is not a bad game in that regard. I think the same studio, Niantic Labs, that made Ingress before that, I actually think Ingress is a more interesting game from the game mechanical point of view. I think it's actually, it's more complex in that way, so it retains your interest longer. I was certainly, I played Ingress much longer than I played Pokemon Go. But it's really true that the challenge based, you know, doesn't have, you know, it doesn't end. You don't feel, oh, I've, you know, finished the story now in the same way. So yeah, so, I agree with you.
So in your studio, you have developed then location based games. So how does the location affect the immersion?
Well, we're hoping with our location-based games, the idea is, a lot of our games, I should mention, are site-specific, right? So they're intended to be played in a particular place, so typically in a cultural heritage site of some kind. And the idea is really that if you're in a particular space, then we as game designers and story developers also, we know something about the space that you're in, right? So we might know what kind of buildings you can see. We might know what kind of sounds you're likely to hear in the background. It's going to be birds. It's going to be children playing. It's going to be traffic. Is it likely to be very windy? Maybe that can be a little bit trickier. But we know something about the environment that you're in. And our thinking around those games is really that that we can use that to draw you into the experience, and sort of position you as a player between the between the game world and the real world in an interesting way, right? So we want people for our games, and our goal is very different from, say, like Pokemon Go's goal here. We want people not to be drawn too much into the game mechanics, right? We want them to feel like they're present in the physical space. We don't want them to lose that sense of presence in the physical space, because they might be in a cultural heritage site, which is going to be of interest to them. And the people who operate cultural heritage sites, they want people to experience their site, right? They don't want them to experience game mechanics exclusively. So we try and reconcile this idea of getting people to feel present in the space with also feeling a sense of immersion into the story, right? And we feel that imaginative immersion is better at doing this than challenge-based immersion would be, because as soon as people have to solve a challenge, or then they get drawn into that sort of flow, if it's a good challenge, they get drawn into the flow and they forget where they are. And that won't work for our games, because we want people to feel where they are, right? Because they are in an interesting place, and it's a place that has cultural relevance so that's really important. So for our games, imaginative immersion is a much better fit, and we try and blur that boundary between the game world and the real world in order to make them sort of meld together a little bit, and just get the player maybe sometimes a little bit uncertain about, oh, this bird that I heard, did that belong to the game world or did it belong to the real world? And maybe it doesn't matter, you know, as soon as we can get them sort of drawn into this story and still feel like they're part of the space that they're in.
So it's really interesting, the exploration of this kind of mixed reality, right? In which is like the game reality, your reality, and how you play in the intersection of both. If this is a way of dealing with immersion in this mixed or of this combination of worlds, but now the hype is in something completely different, which is like virtual reality, which is just detach you from your reality and immerse you into a completely different reality. What do you think is the future of virtual reality?
It's a good question. I mean, I like virtual reality. I think it's quite interesting. It's kind of the, you know, the next step in the traditional gaming experience, where you sit in front of a screen and those screens have become bigger and bigger, you know, over time, right? Yeah, so now you have the screen takes up your entire field of view in virtual reality, and there's definitely a space for that, and it's very much aligned with sort of Janet Murray's original, you know, vision of the holodeck as the perfect storytelling medium, right? So it's her book from 1996, I think. So that's really where virtual reality is going. I think augmented reality and mixed reality has a potential that I think is really intriguing, and that's why we've been working in this space of, in a way, I see it as the opposite of virtual reality. So virtual reality is all about the players stepping in to the game world, you know, and becoming part of that world on that world's terms. Whereas for augmented reality, the way I see it, it's almost the opposite. It's like we're bringing the game world out into the real world, and the player interacts much more on real world terms. They walk around physically, right, in a real environment to interact with the content, rather than stepping into the world. So it's like it's almost sort of inside out, you know, compared to virtual reality, and I like that a lot, and I like the real world. You know, it's nice to use that as a canvas, you know, rather than creating a whole new canvas and putting someone into that canvas.
Mm-hmm. And with all this research and development and new ground to explore in terms of gaming and storytelling, do you think the future of education will go and take elements of all these gaming and storytelling aspects?
I guess maybe we should talk about this later on in the year when we have our experience with the Gaming for Peace project. If that actually turns out to work, you know, nicely, if we can actually show that people learn real things, you know, from playing that game, you know, things that are really useful for them, then I think there's a real potential there. I mean, educational games have had a bad reputation for a long time because it's actually really hard to design a game that is interesting to play as an experience, that's not boring, and at the same time has some education content. It's really hard. Most games are not that interesting if they're educational. So we're hoping that this will be an exception. And we really paid a lot of attention to this when we've designed it, right? We were always thinking, oh, this needs to be interesting to play. It doesn't necessarily need to be fun and the same that, you know, but it needs to be interesting. It needs to make you think, and it needs to get you immersed into the story. That's what we're hoping. And it could be, maybe there'll be more. I mean, we'd love to make more, games of this type in the future if it turns out that it works.
Nice. So, Mats, for our listeners, if they want to follow you or your work, where should they go?
On Twitter is probably the best place at the moment. Our Twitter handle is Haunted Planet. My personal Twitter handle is Matt Haar, but probably the Haunted Planet one is the best if they're interested in this work in about games.
Okay, thank you very much, Matt. It's been fantastic. It's been a pleasure. We've learned a lot. We wish you the best with Gaming for Peace, and we will talk soon, so you can just share the results of the project with us.
That's great. Thanks so much, Brilliant. Pleasure talking to you.